in regards to the LHC, the absolutely most important things to be doing have to do both with the experiment and on the theory side with understanding the very important issues of backgrounds and coming up with some new analysis strategies that might help us, especially early on. And you've had two excellent talks on those subjects earlier this morning. So I want to talk about something else. I want to talk about something which is not going to be solved in a year, very likely, no matter what we learn from the LHC, but does have to do with, I think, very important problems that are going to be here to stay for a while. Again, likely not solved on the one-year timescale, but which are, but which will be with us for a while, and I think we'll have to struggle for a while. And this just begins with something which I think is hard to disagree with, that the biggest crises and opportunities in fundamental physics today have to do with the, everything to do with the landscape, the questions of vacuum selection, and that involves fundamental issues of quantum mechanics applied, quantum mechanics and gravity applied to closed systems and entire universe. And these issues eventually have to be dealt with. We may have thought 10 or 20 years ago that these issues have to be dealt with anyway, but that as far as determining the vacuum goes, there would be a unique vacuum so we could factorize the problems and worry about these issues some other time. And physics has a very nice way of not allowing you to factorize issues and force you to address fundamental problems. Now, the essential issue here is that something goes wrong with locality and gravity, and not just at the Planck scale. And we've known this for a while in the context of the information paradox, where long-distance effective field theory makes a very, very clear prediction that information is lost or they're long-lived remnants. And that's wrong. Even though curvatures are low, there's no reason to think that long-distance effective field theory should be breaking down. It gives the wrong answer. And a very grown-up version of this problem is are all the confusing issues having to do with approximate de Sitter spaces and the landscape, the fact that naively on one of these infinite spatial slices in an eternally inflating space-time, all these degrees of freedom are independent of each other, and therefore every question you ask involves an infinity. But this is not a new issue. We already have an issue like this staring at us in the context of the black hole information problem, where even though we think we know the answer, that information isn't lost, we still don't know how to describe the fate of the infalling observer through the event horizon, where nothing should be happening to him or her. And so the question is, can we talk about local things? Now, gravity makes it impossible to have an exact local things. But is there any sense in which we can approximately talk about local things? And while in the context of the black hole, we might have the luxury to talk about exactly sharply defined things like the S matrix. Finally, in cosmology, we are really like these guys falling through the event horizon. So the question is there some way of talking about local things? And of course, local really means flat space. Okay, in any geometry, local physics means the flat space part of the geometry. So somehow we have to learn how to talk about flat space in a way that doesn't have manifest locality. We have to do that eventually because locality is not going to be an exact principle because of gravity. But I think there's a natural, simpler problem. We have to learn how to do that somehow. And it's hard to imagine how to give up locality and have some sort of approximate locality. But there's a very natural, question that you can ask, which is, can we talk about ordinary quantum field theory without gravity, or I should say without non-perturbative gravity? Can we talk about ordinary quantum field theory in a different way that isn't manifestly local? Is there some way of just computing the S matrix, for example? So I'm just going back to the S matrix program. Is there some way of computing the S matrix directly without ever making reference to the space-time physics? See, if we learned how to do this, this, I think, has a lot of the non-trivial trick in it, whatever it is. Because we'll figure out some way of talking about physics that we know in another language is exactly local, but in a way that isn't manifestly local. And whatever that is I think going to be a closer starting point to trying to incorporate gravity, which makes locality impossible to begin with. I think an analogy is in going from classical mechanics to quantum mechanics. If you started off with Newton's laws, they were manifestly deterministic. In quantum mechanics, we have to lose manifest determinism. And so Newton's laws are a very bad jumping off point to get to quantum mechanics. But the least action principle is simply a reformulation of standard classical mechanics. But it does not have manifest determinism in it. In fact, when you first learn about it, it seems a little mysterious that it should be deterministic, because it seems like the trajectory of the particle will know about the point B in the future of the point A. But, you know, it doesn't. But this is the formulation of classical mechanics that's not manifestly deterministic, and therefore offers a much better jumping off point to quantum mechanics, where there isn't determinism. I want something like that for good old-fashioned local quantum field theory, a description of it that's not manifestly local, but which is equivalent to standard quantum field theory. Now, this is a highfalutin reason to expect that such a reformulation exists. But there's a pragmatic evidence that such a theory exists. And even the pragmatic evidence goes back to exactly the same issue of locality again. Because we try to describe quantum field theory in a manifestly local way, that forces us in our description in local field theory into a huge amount of redundancy. If I give you a field theory, there's many equivalent field theories to it. We have field redefinitions, we have particles with spin, we have gauge and Diffeo redundancies. And all of these redundancies show up very practically in the computation of scattering amplitudes. When you compute scattering amplitudes, when you go even to moderately large number of external legs, there's an enormous number of diagrams at any number of points. There's an enormous number, in fact, more and more, as you go to these theories with more and more redundancy. So manifest locality is forcing you to have these bazillions of diagrams. But when people actually compute them, the amplitudes turn out to be much, much simpler. And furthermore, they show regularities that are completely invisible in the formulation in terms of a quantum field theory. So locality is coming at a heavy price. It's making it very complicated to calculate, and it's hiding the structure of the actual answer. Now, of course, this is an old and very beautiful subject, trying to figure out how to compute amplitudes more efficiently than just dumbly adding up Feynman diagrams. It goes back to the 80s and 90s with the beautiful work of Park and Taylor, the very powerful unitarity methods of Baron Dixon and Kossauer et al. These are all, I think, characterized, you can characterize them as sort of bottom-up approaches of trying to find different ways of actually doing computations. Then earlier this decade, there was a top-down attempt by Witten, the twister string theory, which was supposed to really give you a boundary theory for the S matrix in flat space. You should really think of the S matrix program as the attempt to do holography for flat space. And in fact, these variables that enter, I'm not going to talk about twisters basically at all for the rest of the talk, but I just want to mention that these variables, you know, they go back to Penrose. The reason Penrose introduced them was precisely with very holographic sounding motivations. Twisters are associated with light-like lines. Light-like lines label the boundary of asymptotic infinity in a very nice way, and it's very natural for such a boundary theory to depend on those variables. So this was a conjecture for what a theory would be with no local space-time at all, which computed the amplitudes in a different way, and it stimulated a great deal of work. But I should say, this particular idea was very special to four dimensions. These so-called maximal helicity violating amplitudes played a special role. And somehow this is very closely related to self-duality, very closely related to the fact that Yang-Mills in four dimensions has a nearly integrable subsector of self-dual solutions. And for these reasons, I think these are the physical reasons why it didn't actually work at beyond tree level. However, these ideas led to something else, which I think is deeper and more powerful. They led to these beautiful recursion relations of Brito, Cacciazzo, Feng, and Witten, which now can be completely divorced from the origin up here. It can be described from the bottom up and are much, much more general. In fact, even though they were described within the same context of four-dimensional theories using spinner variables that are naturally suited to talking about four dimensions, they have nothing whatsoever to do with four dimensions and are really a very general property of field theory. So I want to tell you what they are, now it's been long known in the In fact, the beginning of the S matrix program is to think about complexifying all the momenta when you talk about a scattering amplitude. Somehow the nicest properties are apparent in the complex plane for all the amplitudes. And if we're talking about scattering amplitudes, there's the incredibly simple possible singularity structure that you can have. At tree level, all you can have are poles. And the poles correspond to when you take a bunch of particles, and they can together go on shell. Then as they approach the place where you go on shell, the amplitude has to factorize into the product of two pieces for a lower point amplitude on the left, lower point amplitude on the right, and a propagator. But that's very general. And these guys 40 years ago couldn't really figure out how to do this for anything other than 2-to-2 scattering. The remarkable thing is that there's a very beautiful way of doing it in complete generality for an any point function. And the idea is to complexify the momenta, not in the most general way, but in the simplest possible way. Well, the dumbest possible way you might want to complexify momenta is to make one momentum complex. But you can't do that, because that doesn't conserve momentum. So the next dumbest thing you can do is to complexify two momenta. And that's what you do. Okay, so take a general amplitude here. I'm labeling it by the momenta on the outside. What I'm calling the helicities of the particles as well, although in a general number of dimensions, that helicity means the generalization of helicity to a general number of dimensions. So I have this amplitude. And we're going to pick two lines, two momenta, J and K. And we're going to make them complex, conserving momentum and keeping them on shell in the following way. You take the momentum PJ. You translate the PJ plus a reference vector Q times Z. And PK goes to PK minus a reference vector Q times Z. Z is the complex parameter. This evidently conserves momentum. And for everything to be on shell for any value of Z, you see that you have to have Q dot PJ and K equals 0 and Q squared equal to 0. Now, it's very easy to see that those two properties are impossible to satisfy for real momenta. But it's easy to satisfy them for complex momenta. So let me go to a frame. These are all massless particles. Let me go to a frame where simplicity, where J and K are back-to-back in units where the energy is 1. We can say if I make that choice for Q, then Q is manifestly orthogonal to J and K, and Q squared vanishes because of that I. So I can do this for complex momenta. If you don't like complex momenta, I can also do this keeping all the momenta real but changing the signature to a D minus 2 comma 2 signature. But really, you should get used to thinking about complex momenta, and that's actually a more fundamental thing. All right, that's what you do to the momenta. What do you do to polarization vectors? I won't go through this in detail, but it's just incredibly straightforward, other than to point out that before I deform the momenta, notice there's something interesting about that vector Q. It is the minus polarization vector for J, and the plus polarization vector for K. So that means that there's a natural basis for the polarization vectors, which are minus plus, and the transverse ones if you have more than 4 dimensions. And there's some way of deforming these polarization vectors so that when you deform the momenta, the polarization vectors stay orthogonal to their corresponding momenta. Okay? So all I want you to get from here is that this is just a linear change. Some of the polarization vectors don't change. Some of them change linearly with Z. Otherwise, it's very simple. So starting with this real amplitude, I now get, as a function of the, where I'm keeping track of the helicities of J and K, because it'll be important in a second, I get a complex amplitude M of Z. Now, the essential kinematical observation of BCF and W is that this function M of Z only has simple poles. And that's in the complex plane. That's obvious. The only places where Z's are downstairs are in propagators. And so here we are. In fact, here is a general propagator has a momentum that's just some over some subset of the external momenta, which I'll call capital J here. And now when I turn on Z, what happens is, well, it depends. If those particles J and K were on this side, then the Z's and their momenta add up to 0, and PJ doesn't change. If one of them is on one side, one of them is on the other side, then it shifts linearly in Z in one direction or the other. But the important point that this P squared as a function of Z is what it was with Z equals 0 plus 2 PJ dot QZ. And there's no Q squared Z squared piece because Q squared equals 0. And therefore, this has a pole. This has a pole at this particular value of Z, which is in general complex. Okay? So for every way of dividing the momenta into two sets, there is a pole at some complex value of Z. And notice that the residue of this function as Z goes to that point is something very nice. the residue is the product of two on-shell lower point amplitudes. And it's on-shell, but at a complex value of the momentum. That was the whole point of complexifying and keeping things on-shell. Okay, now what's the rub? If it's true that this analytically continued M of z goes to zero as z goes to infinity, then standard complex analysis tells us that we can reconstruct the entire function M of z from the knowledge of the residues of its poles. That's a standard complex analysis argument. And so that tells us that I can construct what I want, which is M at z equals zero, the undeformed M, in terms of a sum over all the other residues. Well, the other residues, remember, were the product of lower point amplitudes evaluated at some complex value of z, and therefore you get a formula that the amplitude, the higher point amplitude you're interested in, is a sum over all ways of splitting things up into two sets with j on one side and k on the other, and the sum of the helicities of the internal particles here of the product of these two on-shell amplitudes times a propagator. So these are the on-shell BCFW recursion relations. And again, so this is very beautiful because it's a way of calculating amplitudes, never mentioning anything off-shell. Everything is completely on-shell here, but at complexified values of the momentum. And in actual, I'm not talking about practical computations, but this is shockingly effective in actually computing things. You can calculate using the recursion relations, you know, on your taxi back to Pearson, the 5.2 to 3 gluon amplitude like it's nothing. Okay. But I'm more interested in the conceptual issues for today. Now, what's nice about that is that you can actually recursively reduce everything down to something that you can't recurse further, which is a three-point amplitude. And this actually contains the essential magic of this business right here. Normally, we don't talk about this object. Normally, we don't talk about a three-point amplitude because you can't put all three particles on shell. But you can for complex momentum. So this is a completely on-shell, nice amplitude for general complex momentum. Furthermore, this object is very remarkable. You see, there's no non-zero kinematical invariance here. P1 and P2 are on-shell. P3 is P1 plus P2 is on-shell. So all the dot products, everything, P1 squared, P2 squared, P3 squared, P1 dot P2, 2 dot 3, 3 dot 1, everything vanishes. There's no analog of S and T for this amplitude. So it can only be determined completely and uniquely by the spins of the particles. It carries the essence of the Lorentz transformation properties of the particles 1, 2, and 3. This was emphasized in a beautiful paper by Cacciazzo and Benincasa recently. And in fact, in four dimensions, it's particularly nice. Here, for the only time in the talk, I'll revert to the spinner helicity formalism, where you write a momentum as a product of two spinners, just to show you how beautiful this expression is. There's some totally general expression for any spin particle. For example, for spin one, it's just this incredibly simple object. And all these things in the numerator and denominator are doing is giving you the appropriate net one number, two number, and three number to account for the helicities of the particles. And for example, for spin two, it's just exactly that structure squared. So this reflects, you know, one of the mantras in this business, going back to the work of Kai Llewellyn Tai, that gravity amplitudes are like the square of gauge amplitudes. But this is one of the most precise manifestations that I've seen. And again, you know, even if you just write down the three-point vertex in gravity, it has 90 terms in it. Okay, this is the answer for what it is on shell. Okay. When did I start? Okay, great. Now, but in fact, the rub that I mentioned is actually quite surprising. And this behavior of the amplitudes as z goes to infinity is surprising. You remember, all that magic happened if we assume that these amplitudes vanished as you go off in a particular complex direction in momentum space. But in fact, that's naively never true. Okay. Let's say you take phi to the four theory. In phi to the four theory, look, the 2 to 2 amplitude is just a constant. Obviously, it doesn't vanish. And you might think that there are one over z's in the propagator, which there are generically, but there's always some subdiagram like this one, where there's no z's flowing in here at all. And therefore, the amplitudes in phi to the fourth theory go to a constant. They don't vanish. Okay? Now, naively, gauge amplitudes and gravity amplitudes are worse and worser. Okay? That's because they have momenta in the vertices. So, for instance, the gauge amplitudes have a single factor of momentum in the vertex, which would go like z. The propagators might go like 1 over z, but you see there's always one more vertex than propagator. And that's before you multiply by the polarization vectors that either go like a constant or go like z to the 1. So for Yang-Mills, and for gravity, it's even worse because there's z squareds there at the vertices. And so you would expect this amplitude to get worse and worse when you have more and more external legs. So in fact, let me make a little table. Just keeping track of these four-dimensional helicities, although this is all true in any number of dimensions, this is naively what you'd expect for the gauge amplitudes. Okay, they would grow depending on the helicity of the x or z's coming from the polarization vector, the z, z squared, or z cubed, worse than phi to the fourth theory. And for gravity, it's even way worse. It goes like z to the n minus 1 up to z to the n plus 3, where n is the number of external gravitons. However, the actual answer is completely different. The actual behavior of these amplitudes, remember, this is going to infinite momentum. So the actual behavior is that for gauge theory, these amplitudes actually, some of them die like 1 over z, whereas this one keeps going like z cubed. For gravity, a beautiful series of papers by Cacciazzo, Svercek, Cacciazzo, Benincasa, and others actually showed that not only doesn't it diverge horribly like this, it's better behaved than the gauge theory. Okay? The amplitudes that vanished before are better behaved than the gauge theory. They vanish like 1 over z squared. And you'll also notice, again, this pattern, that the large z scaling of the gauge of the gravity amplitudes are the square of the large z scaling of the gauge amplitudes. Now, these were found in a whole variety of different methods and for some amplitudes and not others. So what was needed, my student and I thought, was a physical understanding of why this was happening, also that allowed one to generalize and understand what was going on in general in four dimensions for all amplitudes and in higher dimensions. Now, I'm not going to have time to go through this to go through the argument in detail, but let me just give you a flavor for what is going on, why there's this remarkable simplification in this large z limit. And the reason is very obvious, that large z is a very simple physical limit. As I go to large z, I'm making these two momenta, j and k, almost infinite and equal and opposite to each other. They're both incoming momenta, so that's really one very hard particle coming in and one very hard particle going out. The only thing that's unusual, now for real momenta, this is the Iconal limit, we're very used to it. The only thing which is unusual is that the momentum is complex. Okay. But anyway, we can take the intuition from the Iconal limit that there should be not much scattering, and that importantly, the helicity should be conserved. And what we did in our paper is essentially formalize these arguments more so that we could actually directly apply it to the case of interest. The not much scattering part turned out to need, in general, a nice choice of a sort of background light cone gauge to make very apparent. I don't want to focus on that because it's very simple, but it's a little technical. But the part which I think is more interesting goes to the difference of why the scalar theory is worse than the gauge theory is worse than gravity, why the intuition is reversed. And the best theory seems to be the one that's the most complicated from the usual point of view. And that has to do with a certain kind of symmetry associated with spin that becomes manifest at infinite momentum. We can see this already in Yang-Mills. So in order to study this limit of a hard particle blasting through a soft background, it's of course convenient to use background field method. So let me do that. I'm going to expand the field as the background and the fluctuation. I'll do the usual gauge fixing in the textbooks for the fluctuation gauge symmetry to get this form of the Lagrangian. You see there are the two familiar terms, the magnetic moment coupling, the part that just looks like four scalars. Now, I've done something a little funny here. Normally, these are all the same kind of index, mu and nu. I've just arbitrarily decided to call the index of the fluctuation A and B instead of mu and nu. I'm perfectly free to do that. But I'm doing that because, you see, at infinite momentum, this term is more important than that one. And if you drop this term, there's a funny kind of Lorentz invariance, which is enhanced at infinite momentum. There's a Lorentz invariance that just rotates the index acting on A. It's not the real Lorentz invariance. The real Lorentz invariance is broken by the background. No, it's a kind of spin Lorentz invariance that only acts on the spin index of the theory. And that Lorentz invariance really allows you to completely control the structure of the amplitude as a series expansion in Z. You know, the most divergent term as Z goes to infinity all comes from this piece of the theory. So the amplitude as a function of Z definitely might have pieces that grow like Z, but that piece does not break the spin Lorentz invariance. So it's proportional to this A to AB. Then the rest is just a very simple Spurion analysis to see how this breaking enters. And so you get this kind of ansatz, where A is an anti-symmetric matrix because F is anti-symmetric, B is general, and so on. And then using Ward identities, one can immediately see that when you dot that form of the amplitude into the polarization vectors, you produce all of the scalings that I mentioned before. Okay, so all those funny scalings, something's going like 1 over z, the other goes like z cubed, and so on, they're all just reflecting this spin Lorentz invariance of the underlying theory in this large z limit. And in fact, you get this kind of table for a general number of dimensions of how the amplitude scales, and you can check it's correct in examples. And it's also enough that just minus and anything vanishes, so that, in fact, these BCF recursion relations, as you see, have nothing to do with twisters or anything like that, and they apply to Yang-Mills theory in any number of dimensions greater than or equal to 4. The story for pure gravity turns out to be similar when you now just again do exactly the same thing, background field, graviton fluctuation around the background. You get a form, again, that's, you know, standard from Tuff-Veltman papers and so on. It looks very similar. In the place of the magnetic coupling involving F, there is an analog of the magnetic coupling involving Riemann. There's a little bit of song and dance to turn these indices into Lorentz indices because we want to use a spin Lorentz invariance. We don't want to have space-time indices. But anyway, the important point is that there are two copies of this spin Lorentz invariance that control the gravity amplitudes. And when you do exactly the same analysis as we did for gauge theory, you find that the large Z scaling of the gravity amplitudes precisely have the tensor and Z scaling structure of the product of two gauge amplitudes. So I think this is, again, a very sharp general version of this gravity is gauge squared type statement, where you see precisely that this amplitude, and, you know, it looks like it has many complicated pieces coming from different parts of the theory. This piece came from the Riemann tensor. It was antisymmetric in AB and A twiddle, B twiddle, because those are the symmetry properties of the Riemann tensor and so on. But all of those things package up precisely to give you the Z and tensor structure of the product of two gauge amplitudes. And that's what explains why the large Z scaling of gravity is the same as gauge theory. Okay, so there's some table like this, which is anyway, it doesn't even matter. It's just the square of the gauge amplitudes. But the important point is that these BCF ideas apply, again, to gravity amplitudes in any number of dimensions. Okay. So with my remaining few minutes, I now want to, we've seen something quite peculiar, that that the naively simplest theories, like phi to the fourth theory, are actually the most terrible. From the point of view of the actual amplitudes. You know, the actual amplitudes don't show nearly the same simplicity that the gauge amplitudes do, and the gravity amplitudes are, in a sense, even better behaved. So now comes the question, then. So what is the simplest quantum field theory? Well, if you open up a textbook, I think this is probably the way. You go from phi to the fourth theory, Yang, Mills, gravity, and then, in some sense, the most complicated version of Yang, Mills is n equals 4, and the most complicated version of gravity is n equals 8. And I say they're complicated despite the fact that they have a lot of symmetry, because we don't know any good formulation that makes all that symmetry obvious. So it's actually a pain in the butt. Having all that symmetry is a sort of pain in the ass. You don't know that you've done the computation properly. You can't check it easily. But I would say that the reason why we call this the simplest theory and not the most complicated theory is because of the language that we've grown up with. We call these the simplest theory and the most complicated theory because our local description of them is the simplest. This is the quantum field theory whose local description is the simplest. This is the quantum field theory whose local description is the most complicated. But remarkably, while of course we know n equals 4 supernulls has many remarkable properties in perturbation theory and beyond, and I think it's conceivable that, as we've seen in progenitors and the tree amplitudes, in some sense it might be true. In some sense it might be true that n equals 8 supergravity is the simplest quantum field theory. It's certainly one that's governed by the largest spin Lorentz invariants at tree level. And what we've been seeing in the ongoing collaboration with Freddy is that that feeds in a quite transparent and direct way into the properties of the theory at loop level. But I want to give you some idea of why it is that it's n equals 4 and n equals 8. You know, it isn't just because they're the most symmetrical theories and they're the nicest theories. There's something much more specific than that, I think. So we've seen that it's the amplitude of particles with spin that are so nicely behaved. But as soon as you have spin, as soon as you have any spin, you have a basic problem that the amplitudes are fundamentally discrete objects. You know, because I have to add plus and minus helicities by hand, they're separate representations. They're not, the theory isn't automatically CPT invariant. I have to really add plus and minus separately by hand. And so the objects that I have to compute in the end are things like plus, plus, minus, minus, plus, plus, plus. These sort of very discrete objects, more and more legs, there's more and more kinds of them. And again, it's due to the fact that Yang-Mills and gravity have this kind of spectrum. Okay? And that one in one and that one in minus one are not related to each other. What is remarkable about n equals 4 and n equals 8 is that they relate them all to each other. It isn't merely that they have so much symmetry. I think it's this more specific reason that n equals 4 and n equals 8 relate with a symmetry all of the components. I can get to the top of the multiplet from the bottom of the multiplet using the SUSY. And what that means concretely is that the amplitudes are actually not labeled by their helicities, but by something much smoother. You should actually label the states not by specific helicity states, but by fermionic Grassmann coherence states, obviously. So, you know, I take the bottom, I apply e to the q bar eta to it, and that builds me a state eta. I could take the top, apply e to the q eta twiddle to the top helicity state, get a state eta twiddle. This is the choice, and they're complementary to each other, because one set diagonalizes q and the other set diagonalizes q bar. In fact, this complementarity between eta and eta twiddle is also the reason why MHV and anti-MHV amplitudes, you can't talk about them conveniently at the same time. It's exactly the same thing. MHV amplitudes are making the action of q obvious, MHV bar the action of q bar. But anyway, they're related to each other by a Fourier transformation, however you like. But the point is that now the amplitudes are fully smooth objects. They're functions of these Grassmann parameters and of the momenta. There's no more funny discrete indices on them. So for n equals 4 and n equals 8 are the only theories where the amplitudes are completely smooth objects. And that implies quite remarkable properties. I don't have time to explain it, but something that we've been doing with Freddy and Jared is using a relatively trivial supersymmetric argument. We can show that these BCF recursion relations very nicely extend to n equals 4 and to n equals 8. And everywhere there was a sum before, there's an integral. Okay? So here's a general amplitude labeled by these Grassmann parameters. And all I do, I still have to split them up into two separate steps. But there's no sum over the supermultiplet or sum over helicities. There's this very nice, just smooth integral. There's this interesting shift of one of these Grassmann parameters. But anyway, never mind. What's remarkable about this is that the supersymmetry has been used to transmit the good properties of the highest spin amplitudes to the lower spin ones that are badly behaved. Again, everything is opposite to the usual intuition, where the best is scalar and the worst is gravity. The best is gravity here. And supersymmetry is letting you relate all the best properties of the gravity amplitudes to everything in a completely smooth way. So this is why I think if there is some boundary theory that computes these things nicely, it's most likely to look nicest for n equals 4 and n equals 8 for this specific reason. It's because finally, for these theories, the objects that it should be computing are completely smooth. And as I mentioned briefly, this is in progress, that the excellent behavior of these tree amplitudes very naturally has an imprint at one loop, and I think physically explains and further proves in general the no triangle hypothesis that Baron et al. Have made for one loop amplitudes in n equals 8 supergravity. All right, so that's all I have to say. I have to say that this business is a lot of fun because, you know, we've gone 30 years from experiment, fundamental experiment to fundamental experiment, and, you know, a theorist gets starved for data. But working on a subject is a little bit like having data. If you're trying to reformulate, you know, field theory in some other language, there's a hell of a lot of data, the actual computation of scattering amplitudes by people who compute them for a living. There's an attempt to find a top-down theory that would, you know, dual description for finding out what it is, and there is some middle ground where you can try to come up with partial theories for explaining some of the regularities that that people have been saying. But the really fundamental question is, what is this dual theory? I think many people are convinced that it exists. What's remarkable, of course, is this is a weak duality. Right? We're really saying there's some other way of doing perturbation theory. A weak duality is a much more non-trivial thing than a weak strong duality, because you get to check an infinite number of things rather than, you know, four or five things having to do with symmetries and various protected quantities. So what is the dual theory that explains these amazing properties? And what I've said today, I think, just adds a few things, adds a few clues for what it should be. First, it should exist and be nicest for theories with so much SUSY that allows you to relate all the components to each other by supersymmetry. But furthermore, since these recursion relations are true in any number of dimensions, whatever this theory is should not crucially rely on four dimensions. It should really be a general reformulation of field theory based on principles that can be talked about in any number of dimensions. And a starting point is, forget about all orders and loops and everything, is there an analog of the twister string theory that makes these BCF recursion relations obvious? The Witten's twister string theory made another kind of recursion relation, the so-called Pachazos-Firchak Witten recursion relations, obvious. But those, again, are very MHV related and so on. The question is there some theory that makes these recursion relations obvious? And I think if there is, that would be probably a very good starting point for figuring out this boundary theory. Thank you very much.
Thank you for a fascinating talk. Benny?
Thank you. I have two questions. The first is, as you well know, in n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, there really is not an S matrix.
Right.
And the question is, how do you talk about anything without talking about local quantities? And the second is, possibly outside the framework of these very, very special theories, how would you, without having an idea of locality and Lagrangian and all those sorts of things, talk about the effects of instantons or
right.
the existence of monopoles but solitons
right.
in general?
Right. So I totally agree with the second comment. For the first, I agree the S matrix doesn't exist in four dimensions, somehow, actually, especially for gauge theory, four dimensions is very special though, as we know. Because it's the borderline between where you have UV divergences and IR divergences. And so I think it's reasonable to imagine looking for this theory in 4 minus epsilon dimensions. Hopefully someday, you know, there'll be a more physical way of saying this. But, you know, but these the regularities exist, and you can really imagine computing the S matrix in 4 plus epsilon dimensions where the infrared issues are absent. That's for the first question. My guess is if there is some other theory, that it probably naturally computes something else. But anyway, as I think a guide for possibly finding it, imagining the S matrix in 4 plus 2 epsilon dimensions is a good start. The second point, I entirely agree. I'm not saying that this is, you know, I think this is going to be, if such a different theory exists, it'll just be a different angle on looking at standard local quantum field theory. it'll make different aspects of the theory obvious. Our usual description in terms of local quantum fields makes some things obvious. It makes locality obvious, and it makes, you know, all the other vacuum structure, the non-perturbative effects we talked about, symmetry breaking, blah, blah, blah. It makes all of that stuff obvious. But there's definitely obscuring some things. And so now, I think in the sort of biggest possible dream, you might, biggest possible dream along these lines, is you might imagine finding some bigger theory. And you and Steve Shanker have said things like this. But there are some, you know, reasonably concrete attempts at making these kind of words make sense in the context of theories like this by people at Oxford. You might imagine having some big theory that has really an enormous amount of redundancy. And you gauge fix that redundancy in two different ways. One way turns the theory into a local quantum field theory in four dimensions, in a way that's manifestly local. And another way of gauge fixing it turns it into the kind of boundary theory that we are interested in, that explicitly computes amplitudes. And there are people who talk about the Twisser space constructions, where at least in the abstracts of their papers and the introduction and conclusions, they use exactly those words. I'm so mathematically challenged as to not be able to understand anything in between. But the words are definitely enticing. And anyway, that's the sort of thing I might imagine. So I'm not saying that we should abandon local quantum field theory. It served us very, very well. But I think for understanding these remarkable properties of the actual answer, and B, potentially as a springboard for generalizing and teaching us how to talk about approximate local things when we have gravity, it's worth pursuing.
John, we'll take one more question, John. We'll take the coffee break.
The conventional understanding is that the phi to the fourth theory as a local theory is renormalizable.
Right.
And gravity, including n equal to 8 supergravity, is not renormalizable.
That's what you might think it's not renormalizable, but that's one of the interesting things in this business, is that n equals 8 is much, much better behaved in the UV than anyone thought.
So you're claiming you can prove that n equal to 8 supergravity is renormalizable?
I can't prove that. People have made, I can't prove anything. You know, I certainly can't, prove. But it's definitely beyond my pay grade to make that sort of statement right now. People have said that, you know, Byrne, Dixon, et al. I've said it. There are some quite non-trivial checks at three loops. I want to stress something about this business. I think I and many other people that I know who find this subject interesting could care less if it's actually finite. Who cares if it's perturbatively finite? You know, unlike in gauge theory, where the expansion parameter is something small, in gravity, the expansion parameter is energy over m Planck. And the second you care, which is that energy is above the Planck scale, it's a terrible perturbative expansion no matter what. It's an asymptotic expansion. It breaks down. It's useless anyway. It needs a UV completion anyway. There's black holes. There's all sorts of states that are just not obviously there in this perturbative description. That's not why at least I care. Why I care is it might be the simplest quantum field theory. certainly n equals 4 and n equals 8 have the chance to be the simplest theory from this alternate point of view. And so that's what's worth exploring about them. There's definitely some structure. But in any case, the naive statement that it isn't renormalizable is already, you know, it's there. But you see, that kind of statement is already belied from the kind of things that I showed you. Those naive large Z scalings of the gravity amplitudes are exactly what you'd get from some naive power counting analysis. You know, gravity is two derivatives, amplitudes blow up. No, the actual answer is better than any other theory. And that's what makes it, opens the possibility that it could be that our usual Wilsonian way of thinking about renormalizability might be false in certain, at least in certain very special cases. It might be, I don't know. But I think it is interesting to explore
It's very thought provoking. Let's thank Niemöhr again. We'll have the coffee break and.